It's time now for the Border News Roundup. Friday mornings at this time, we get a chance to check in with Marshall Helmberger, the editor and the publisher of the Timberjay. It's a newspaper serving northeastern Minnesota. Well, I talked to you, wasn't it just yesterday? It was a very fast week, wasn't it?
Seems like it. I know.
Hi, Marshall. Thanks for being here. Last week, we talked about the PolyMet decision, but since we last talked, you've done a deeper dive on the analysis of this because it's kind of an unusual situation where both sides are saying they had a victory.
Right, and it's a complex case, and there were a lot of elements to it. And, of course, it makes it more difficult to determine, I guess, what all the ramifications of the decision are. But it was interesting because, you know, right away, and I think we talked about this last week, you know, a lot of the environmental groups who were party to this, they were all claiming, a big victory here. At the same time, PolyMet, they issued a press release as sort of a follow-up to their initial press release. And they were, taking shots at their opponents. They said, in this release, they said, despite the media narrative spun by opponents of our project, the Minnesota Supreme Court opinion ruled in PolyMet's favor in 6 of the 8 issues, including the most significant legal issue. And, then they listed the 6 of the 8, issues that had come before the court. And in those cases, in fact, they did rule in favor of the DNR and PolyMet. I guess so if you're going to just, base it on a, 6-2, head count like that, you could say, well, the DNR and PolyMet won. The only issue, of course, is that, I think if you had looked at their original hope, if the DNR and PolyMet had hoped that this decision would sort of get this phase of litigation behind them, and allow them to, start moving forward with, the mine, that was not achieved by this. It's quite clear that that this decision almost certainly guarantees potentially years of additional first administrative process, as they because the Supreme Court did determine that the DNR. We'll need to do a contested case hearing on the use of the clay known as bentonite. And so that's going to take months, to go through that process. And then they'll have to do a reissuance of a permit. It'd have to be an amended permit, potentially, assuming that they go forward with the permit at that point. But assuming they do, then that permit would be subject to additional litigation, potentially. I mean, certainly it would be open to that. So, and it was interesting, too, because the court noted in a footnote that they did not actually rule on the merits of the permits themselves. Their decision was based on whether or not it was limited to whether the DNR had the authority to deny a contested case hearing on these some of these questions that the environmental groups were raising. And they said, because we conclude that the DNR must hold a contested case hearing on the bentonite amendment, we believe a decision on the legal sufficiency of the permits is premature. So they're already signaling here that they're expecting that, they will eventually have to rule on the legal sufficiency of these permits, but that wasn't even really at issue here yet. So, by the time they get to that issue, we could be talking 2-3 years down the line, potentially more. So, I mean, there's so many twists and turns in this yet to come that, certainly if their hope was that this decision was going to clear the way for the mine in the near future, I don't think that was achieved here at all. And there's going to be some sticky issues. Figuring out or setting a term for this. Some of the environmental attorneys I spoke with, they believe that the DNR is going to have a very difficult time establishing a finite term for this permit. That was one of the other issues that the Supreme Court raised, was that it had to have a set term when it actually would be considered closed and the permit would expire. That was not included in the permit, and some of the environmental attorneys say they think this was because the DNR really didn't know how or when they were going to be able to close the site because of some of the very tricky issues involving the highly acidic water that is going to be potentially generated by the waste rock involved here. So it's going to be a very interesting process to watch move forward, but it's going to be a long time before we have any resolution.
Well, let's stick with that idea of water and pollution. You did a story this week on wild rice waters and sulfate having to do with the EPA. Tell us what's new there.
Yeah, well, the Environmental Protection Agency, they actually added Lake Vermilion, the Pike River, and 28 other water bodies in northern Minnesota to the state's list of what are called impaired waters, and that's due to pollution from sulfate, and most of that is generated by taconite mining operations on the Iron Range. Now, the EPA took this step after the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency had actually refused to add these lakes and streams that are impacted by sulfate to their list of impaired waters. And that list includes lakes and streams that have to develop that the MPCA has to develop a plan then for how they're going to clean up the water quality in these bodies. And so by putting these lakes and streams on this list, that does put pressure then on the MPCA under the Federal Clean Water Act that they're going to have to take some action to start to try to clean up these waters. And, of course, the MPCA has been refusing to do that, and they say because the Minnesota legislature has prohibited them from regulating the discharge of sulfate until they can amend the current standard. Minnesota does have the nation's strictest sulfate limit, and that's based on an effort to protect wild rice, and that's set at 10 milligrams per liter. But the state has not enforced that law since it was passed back in the early 1970s. And the legislature was hoping to weaken that standard, but they've run into problems because under federal law you can't do that until you have some kind of scientific basis. You'd have to be able to do some studies showing that the standard was needlessly strict. But the legislature did fund some of that research back around 2015, but it turned out that the studies just confirmed that the wild rice was sensitive to sulfide, which is actually created in a natural environment by sulfate. So adding sulfate to a system, aquatic system, does increase the level of sulfide generally. And so because of that, they basically confirmed that the 10 milligram per liter standard was legitimate. So it's been an ongoing battle between environmental groups and also tribes in Minnesota, northern Minnesota tribes, who are, you know, concerned about the deterioration of wild rice in some of these areas that have been affected by the sulfate discharges. So this is going to be an issue that certainly continues, I think, and whether this adding these lakes and streams to this impaired waters list will make a difference, it remains to be seen. I mean, at this point, the MPCA has been kind of walking a fine line with getting pressure from the one side by the EPA and, you know, and tribes. On the other hand, getting pressure from the legislature, which seems to be taking its orders mostly from the mining industry, which is trying to block any enforcement on sulfate discharge.
Okay. Couple complicated issues there.
Well, they are.
Yeah, yeah. Let's move on to a good news story. I know that the Orr Bog Walk is a special place to you. What's the status and what's it like there?
Well, the status is right now it would be tough to walk on because it's under reconstruction. But within a few weeks here, it sounds like mid-June because progress is going well. They're anticipating that they will have the Orr Bog Walk, which is about a half-mile walk through a whole series of different wetland types. It's actually a pretty unique area right near the entrance to Orr, and it should be completed hopefully by mid June. So folks might want to put that on their calendar and think about making a trip to check out the new Bog Walk. It was originally built back in like 92, and I actually was hired to do the design and interpretive work for that Bog Walk. And it held up pretty well, but, you know, over the years it started to need some significant repair. And so they decided to do a full reconstruction, and they got the funding for that. And I think in part, you know, it was because, you know, it was funny because when we originally built the Bog Walk, you know, back 30-some years ago, there was a lot of folks in town who kind of laughed at it and thought it was, you know, who's going to want to go on that? It was, some folks referred to it as a bug walk. And, but, you know, over the years, I think people have seen that it's been a nice amenity in Orr. A lot of locals use it, and a lot of visitors as well stop there and you know, do the Bog Walk, and then check out the visitor center there, and then maybe go to the restaurants in town. So I think they've seen that it's been a benefit, and that's one of the reasons that the city wanted to make the investment to rebuild it. But mostly they got the, you know, grant funds, and that certainly helped. And but the city did have to put some of its own money into it as well, because the price tag went up, not surprisingly, because a bog walk or boardwalk is made primarily of wood, and we all know what's happened to lumber prices lately. But anyway, I'm looking forward to having that work done. And the thing that's nice about it, like I mentioned, it does go through a number of wetland types. It starts out in a black ash swamp, and then goes into more of a tamarack and black spruce swamp, and then it goes through a little area of alder, then it goes into along the riverfront. This is the Pelican River, which flows out of Orr Bay on Pelican Lake, and that river stretch is really nice. You can see pelicans and grebes and ducks and all kinds of interesting waterfowl there, and then it goes back into some black spruce swamp, so kind of bog, and so it's a nice mix of wetland types within about a half mile stretch there. So it's a great way to stretch your legs. It's not too onerous for anybody, and it's nice and level, and it's wheelchair accessible. So it's a great opportunity for folks to get out and explore some interesting territory there.
Yeah, and I think we're going to, though the pandemic is waning, people are still kind of sticking close to home, and I think exploring places they've never been. So it's good to learn about a new place we could go to.
Definitely. It's a good place to bring your binoculars to, because it's a good place to birdwatch.
All right. It's Marshall Hellenberger. This has been the Border News Roundup. You can read, see more, learn how to subscribe at timberjay.com. Have a great weekend. We'll check in with you next week.
Sounds great. Thanks, Heidi.